Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome you today to the live broadcast. Thrilled that you took time out of your busy schedules to join us. For those of you who are return attendees and listeners, welcome back. Always awesome to have you with us. And before we begin, just want to express my heartfelt gratitude because of your ongoing support, feedback, recommendations. Do Good to Lead Well is now ranked in the top 0.5% of podcasts globally. So thank you so much for your ongoing support. And the primary reason why this podcast continues to receive such a warm welcome is because of amazing guests. I was so excited, and you could see my hard copy of this book. And as you're not surprised, I go old school with the highlighting. Every page is pretty well, you could almost call out a page number, and I would imagine I've highlighted something. This is an extraordinary book, and I'm really excited to dig in with Scott Osmond and Jacqueline Lane today. As a brief bio, before we jump into the conversation, Scott Osmond is the founder and CEO of 100 Coaches Agency, an organization designed to amplify the collective impact of the world's most iconic leadership thinkers and executive coaches. He is the co-designer of 100 Coaches Agency proprietary curation process and the company's relationship first philosophy. In his role as CEO, he establishes the vision for the company, leads partnerships and business development, and serves as a critical pillar of the 100 Coaches community, which he co-founded with Marshall Goldsmith in 2016. Jacqueline Lane is the president of 100 Coaches Agency and co-designer of the 100 Coaches Agency proprietary curation process and the company's relationship first philosophy. In her role as president, she oversees the growth and development of the agency and serves as a critical pillar of the 100 Coaches community. Jacqueline comes to the world of executive coaching through her previous roles in the energy industry and lifelong commitment to improving the lives of all people by elevating the quality of leadership. And this is just such an exceptional book. So welcome to the program, both of you.
Thank you so much for having us, Craig.
Thanks,
so
Craig.
Happy to be here.
Great to be here.
And this is just amazing. This book is so needed. And what a perfect time. I was thinking in terms of I couldn't have chosen a better time of year to have this. It's New Year's. We're all looking around. How can we be at our best? And it's just a fantastic book, which you co-authored with Marshall Goldsmith, number one executive coach in the world. Feel so privileged that he wrote the foreword for my latest book, and I've known Marshall and respect his work for many years now. So this is just an amazing opportunity. So I have to ask, what is the origin story of this book? Because I think, to me, so many books have been written about coaching others. To me, this was such a critical need around, hey, how can I become more coachable myself?
Yeah, thanks, Craig. That's such a great question. Marshall, since I've known him, has been saying, you know, the most important part of coaching is the person who's being coached. Like, no coach in the world can impact someone if they're not willing to create change. As the agency grew, we were thinking about what book, how we could contribute to the canon of executive coaching. And we started thinking about looking at what books were out there. We realized there was no book out there for the coachee to understand how to show up for coaching and how to be their best selves. And so we talked to Marshall about that. We agreed this was the place that we could really make a contribution. And the book has three parts. The first part is just helping you understand the world of coaching, how to find a coach, you know, all the mechanics of it. And then the middle part is how to show up for coaching. And we talk about our openness framework there. And then the third part, which I'm sure we'll get to, is our aspiration for like why even be coached.
And I think an interesting part of this is, of course, in our work in the agency, we observed that a lot of people don't know how to show up for coaching. There are a lot of things out there telling you how to coach or how to lead, but not a lot of things written about how to be coached or how to follow. And so this was a somewhat unique take. But of course, as often happens in the process of writing a book, we realized that it also applied to ourselves. Mm. And so really began this process for both of us to really explore and understand how can we each become more coachable? How does this apply to our own lives? How can we live this and help other people do it too?
And it's a Wall Street Journal bestseller. Again, awesome. Congratulations. And one of the things that I have to say, it's an incredibly engaging read as well. And I appreciate both of you touching on the personal side of it. And I really respected and related to that transparency, your own vulnerability and openness about, hey, this is my journey and this is how it relates. And I think what it does, and again, I highly recommend this book to everybody listening, it really starts to give you all, you can relate to those questions and that discomfort. And then also the journey around how to become our best selves. And there are already questions lined up, so I'm not surprised. We will get to those. Can you talk about, because I love how you open the book with the basics of coaching, because when you talk to people about what is this whole thing of coaching, there's so many things that pop up. And I joke around, it's almost like Google coaching. You get that spinning wheel of death around. We're going to update your computer now. So you're two of the world's most preeminent experts in coaching and coaching methodologies. Can you share to the listeners, what is coaching? What does it look like in practice?
Coaching is now used to refer to the process of working with someone to get better in some area of life, whether that's, you know, athletics and sports, or even now they have coaches for surgeons to help them get better at surgery. But of course, in our world, we're often talking about executive coaching, leadership coaching, CEO coaching. Those all might be terms to describe what we're really talking about, which is the process as it applies to business and leadership. How do you really improve and get better? And bottom line up front, none of us do it alone. All of us need help and support from other people. We all need a guide. And it just the process of receiving feedback and having someone who has an external perspective reflect truth back to you is a really important growing process for all of us.
I'd also add, the world has gotten incredibly complex. And as a friend of ours says, moving faster and faster. Today's the slowest day of the rest of your life. As leaders, we just can't keep up on our own. And unfortunately, the other truth about leadership is it is very lonely, right? Unlike middle managers where you have peers and you can have a free-flowing conversation, leaders have an impact and decision-making impact on the lives of the people around them. And so they don't get all the information that they need to get as honestly as they could get it. And a coach really fills that gap.
And I love that and really appreciate the notion, the idea of working together. Alan Mulally, who you mentioned as well, the working together management system, right? Yeah. And what I love about all of the fantastic coaches and chief executives that you reference across your book, it's all about we can only be at our best with everyone around us. So that unlocks the highest level of our potential. As I mentioned, already have a question from Andy saying, I've always been curious, what is, if any, difference between counseling and coaching?
Counseling and coaching. Well, if by counseling you mean therapy, coaching impacts all aspects of your life. There is some overlap in, you know, counseling is going to impact your personal life and may also impact your business life. Coaching is focused on impacting your business life and may also impact your personal life. I think that the executive coaches are really trained in understanding the dynamics of business. Some of the work they do, a lot of the work they do is behavioral. So understanding relationships in business, but other is unlocking just the methodology of leadership. Like how do you show up as a leader and practice the work of being a leader? Very different than counseling.
Right. Another key differentiator, I think, is how involved you are with your stakeholders. So often, usually when you're working with a counselor or a therapist, you're doing that alone. And that's great. And that can be really helpful and useful for people, especially when you're working through things like trauma. Anything that requires an actual clinical perspective, counseling or therapy are great interventions. Specifically in the world of executive coaching, you're often including a 360 assessment, for example, where a coach will interview a lot of the people that work with, around, and for you to collect feedback on how you're showing up. And that coach will, throughout an engagement, often help you interact with those stakeholders better, engage them in the process. And that's another key differentiator.
I've got so many comments coming in. Thank you. This is very clear. One of the best answers I've ever heard. So thank you. This is
great. Thank you.
Very, very helpful. Another question coming in from Elaine saying, what are the most challenging areas in your experience to help people or coach people through?
You know, from a coach's perspective, the most challenging part of coaching is working with someone who's unwilling to change. Someone who thinks that they have all the answers, someone who's highly resistant to the process, maybe doesn't think they need to change or shoots down every idea. I think from a coach's perspective, that's the hardest.
Yeah, I mean, it's been remarkable as we've seen, you know, really a diversity of coaching. Most problems can be resolved through coaching. I think that leaders have the capacity to do tremendous things. But as Jacqueline said, if they're willing to do it, if they're unwilling to do the work, then that really is that's a showstopper.
But we've seen coaching apply to all kinds of different challenges. It can be market disruption, merger and acquisition, succession to a major new role.
Or even just, you know, people who, you know, we get the call, you know, this person has been behaving this way for a long time. It's unsustainable within the context of the company. We don't think they can change, but they're so important to us that we want to invest in coaching. And those people, they're actually in some ways some of the most gratifying, because we can see real change in 3 to 6 months. It's just a matter of a great coach unlocks first the insight that this is how you're behaving. And then probably the motivation of, if you don't change that behavior, you're probably going to lose your job. And then three, here's how you can change.
But it reminds me a little bit of that old adage, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Yeah.
And a coach will help you take those little steps to keep making that progress.
And again, great comments coming through. And I love your insight on this, which is around, it's less about the area being coached and the willingness of the person to be self-reflectable and commit to doing the work and being coached. And I love that that idea comes out time and time again, because you really challenge us to reflect on, okay, so then what areas can we be coached in and what opportunities exist when we embrace that process? And you talked about feedback and other things and being accountable, which we'll get to again. More questions. I have one from Dean saying, what's the difference between a good coach and a great coach, in your opinion?
I love this question. I really believe that the best coaches are the people who not just talk the talk, but also walk the walk. An example of that is a coach who themselves is coachable, right? So they don't just talk about and help other people do this. They themselves are open to the process of constant learning, growth, and reinvention. And I think that to me is a really powerful testament to the quality of a coach.
Yeah, I would say the other quality, and I feel even as I'm saying it, this is so difficult, is a coach who has none of their own ego in the coaching relationship. That their only reason for being in the coaching relationship is for the success of the person they're coaching. They don't mind if they say something that gets them fired, that's okay, because they have been true to their coaching engagement. And I think that's really hard. Okay. It's really hard. And yet we see that time and again in our very, very top coaches. They are working in the environment where the only thing that matters is the success of the person they're coaching.
Wow. And again, so many great comments coming in so early in this conversation, and really appreciate both of your points, Jacqueline, you know, around, well, do we as coaches walk the talk? And it reminds me of one of my favorite expressions, you know, take my advice because I won't use it anyways. And it's really around that, hey, I'm going to tell you what to do. I've got this figured out. And as a coach, I love that point around, this is a lifelong journey, as you talk about in the book. As soon as we say, hey, I'm at my apex, that's it. Mm-hmm. You're ceiling. And Scott, I love your point as well. It also reminds me, it's so interesting. One of the biggest privileges I have is that I sit in on these amazing conversations like today. And what you shared reminded me of Howard Bihar, the former founding president of Starbucks International. And he talked about, hey, when he showed up at work, he wasn't thinking about, now, how do I get ahead? his reflex was, I'm going to share the most important messages for the business, even if it gets me fired. Like, even if they're, because that's what I'm responsible for. So I love that linkage. I love what both of you are talking about. I've got multiple questions in the queue around this. Keith, Allison, Samantha, and I was going to ask as well, when I Google search, there are tons of coaches. So how do I decide the best fit for me? Any tips, tricks that you've come up with?
That is a tough one. We write about this a little bit in the book. We have a process at the agency to help do that, but you can mirror it in your own world. The first is identify three coaches, minimum three coaches, that you think are experts and would be a good fit for you. Obviously, we've already identified experts in the agency, but some of the guidelines are, you know, you want someone who has years of experience, ideally, and you want to know who they've coached. In today's world, coaching is less of an embarrassment, more of a badge of honor. And so they should be able to tell you who they've coached. And you want to know who they've coached, both a little bit like you, but also the highest levels to gauge what level they're coaching at. Try to find three coaches that are not identical to each other so that you get, in the course of interviewing them, you get a sense of what you can get from coaching. And having three different coaches, we call that curation. Having three different coaches is going to help you understand what's possible from coaching. And then after you've had the three calls, you'll have a much better sense of who's going to be a great coach for you.
And of course, this is exactly why we created our curation process at the 100 Coaches Agency. Yeah. Is because, in fact, I had dealt with this myself when I went out to hire a coach and I had a lot of difficulty. I mean, I was Googling and looking on LinkedIn and reading different articles and books by different people. All of that is great, but it's a little overwhelming. And so, especially because it's such a trusted and personal relationship, you really want to have the right fit. And of course, it was some of that own frustration that led us to create a better way to find a coach. So feel free to reach out to us as well. We're always happy to be a resource for people.
Thank you again. Great insights in terms of how to go about that process. And as you say, there are just so many when you Google search and everything else. So what do I need? What do I have to do? Here's another question that just popped up from Frank. Do they need to have experience in my industry or in my role to be effective as my coach?
Right? This is one of the most common questions that we get. So I'm really happy to be talking about this. It's a common, I think, instinct for, let's say, they want to learn from someone who's been there, done that. And that might be useful, but it also might not be. You know, for example, sometimes the best tennis coach is not necessarily the best tennis player. It's someone who knows the game of tennis, has been around the game, can see things that you don't see, and knows how to motivate and encourage and give you feedback so that you can really improve your game. Again, might that be someone who had a laudable career in tennis? Perhaps, but not necessarily. And the same is true in the world of coaching. In fact, you know, sometimes we see that it's someone who has been a, let's say, executive in the past or has been in a specific industry, there's this myth that they know more, know better. And so they're often giving advice from their own lived experience, which may or may not be relevant for the person that they're coaching. Because if they've been an executive 10 years ago, well, the world, the industry, the leadership has changed significantly in 10 years.
Well, I think it also depends on what you're looking to get out of coaching. Certain types of leadership behavior that people want to unlock are universal. And in those cases where, you know, I think a coach that has experienced many different types of executives and leadership, a coach with a lot of experience, can be better at understanding how to unlock your particular need. On the other hand, if what you're looking for is a coach to help you strategically in an industry that needs a certain kind of knowledge, then in that case, it might be helpful to have someone who's got that specific need. Most leadership coaching that we see, however, is the former.
And as again, back to our curation process, when we tell people to find three different coaches, maybe one of those three is someone who has experience in your role or your industry. And one of those people is someone who's been coaching a variety of people for many years. It might just be interesting to have a comparative set and see what really you think is going to be the most important and most impactful for you.
So again, a wave of comments coming in. Wow. Someone said, love this insight. I see it all the time where people talking about 10 years ago, where the world has advanced far, far greater.
And again, it's interesting, again, your insights. As a lifelong Lakers fan, I remember when Magic Johnson took over coaching the Lakers and the disaster that happened afterwards, exactly to that point. He was coaching around how he saw the game as opposed to the players on the floor. So really appreciate this. Another question coming in from Ted saying, love the title of your book, Becoming Coachable. I'm wondering, how do I know how coachable I am? Or said another way, what qualities do coachable people possess? Well done, Ted.
Yeah.
Great question.
Wow. Well, let me confess that I was not always coachable.
Say a little louder for that.
And and I know that now because of the work that we did in the book. But what happened to me was I have, you know, had a good career and felt that I was pretty good at having a lot of answers and things were going well. And I didn't think I needed to change anything. Like, I was pretty happy with the way things were. I met a lot of coaches and it never worked out until I realized that just thinking that I didn't have to change made me not coachable. And I found that out when I had a conversation with a coach who said, your belief that you don't have to change is creating severe limitations for you. That whatever you think is good now, you have created a ceiling for how much expansion you could get. So why don't we work on expansion? And that was a game changer for me. And so for me, the thing that I had to realize to become coachable was that I had to be open to change. And once I became open to change, the rest of the issues were not an issue. Other people have other issues that make them less open to coaching. Jacqueline might have to, something that she wants to share.
That's a nudge.
Yeah. It's a journey for all of us. For me, my own experience was a little bit different, where I'm someone who naturally likes change and variety. But my issue was a little different. It's that I was so afraid of hearing feedback. And I was not very open to hearing it, that I would have this visceral reaction in my body to be just, again, to shut down and to not really hear what was being said. So the major unlock for me was realizing that I am more afraid of not knowing the truth than I am of hearing it. You know, despite the fact that it may be uncomfortable, despite the fact that I may not like what I hear or what I see, I have to embrace that feedback, because especially in being in a leadership position, it's essential. I mean, that feedback is such a gift, and learning and growth and development don't happen without it, especially in the context of working with other people, the way those of us who are leaders do. That's the other major element that we both identified. In fact, those two things, being open to change and open to feedback, are actually the first two elements of what we refer to as our openness framework.
Right. And if you can do those two things, you're well on your way to becoming coachable. But really, to get the value out of coaching, you also have to be willing to take action on the change that you're open to and the feedback that you receive. So you get the feedback that, you know what, you need to be a better listener. Then you have to say, great, if I get that feedback, I'm going to take action on it. And if you can do those three things, consider yourself coachable. But there's still one more thing if you really want to like have sustained change.
Right. And this was a big insight from Marshall that it's great to hear feedback and to take action on it, make a change. But that change doesn't really stick unless we have systems of accountability in place. And coaches are naturally really great at that. But you can find accountability in other methods as well. So that the being open to being held accountable and the rigor that comes with that is really essential, because it's so natural for us to slide back into old habits. Mm-hmm. As they say, old habits die hard.
And thank you. And I love that openness framework that you talk about, because you not only present each of those elements, you also talk about why they're so important and how we can live those. And I've got a comment from Trina saying, I thank you, Jacqueline, for saying that you were resistant to feedback and really feared hearing feedback. And great answer. Any other advice for how I can be more open to feedback, or things that I can do to create an environment where I'm not as afraid?
That's a great question, Trina. Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked that. I have found that for me, having a single canned response is really important. So again, especially for people who are in positions of leadership, it's important to ask for the feedback. So asking is step one And step two is having a, you know, an answer that you already know you're going to give. And I'll tell you what that is. The answer is thank you. And just thank you. It's not, I promise I'm going to do better, or here's why I don't do that, or I don't agree with you. Any kind of response actually diminishes the feedback in some way. It's best and most appropriate just to say thank you. And then we can really start the process of accepting, marinating, thinking about it. Sometimes feedback is not helpful feedback. There's always the chance that that's the case. But that doesn't change the fact that we need to be grateful to the person who gave it to us.
Yeah. Feedback is always a gift. And I think if we can frame what we're hearing as a gift, somebody has exposed themselves a little bit to us, which is very generous. And they've shared with us something that they feel we need to know. And it's so much better to be in the light rather than the dark, to hear what is going on for people and how they feel about us than not to know. So encouraging feedback, as Jacqueline said, with a simple thank you, really goes a long way. And eventually, I think you can, Trina, build the muscle to recognize that, you know, feedback is a neutral gift, right? That you're just getting this information. What you choose to do with it is up to you. Don't take it personally, but just receive it.
And it does, I think it does get easier over time. Mm-hmm.
No, and this is great. Again, lots of comments coming through. And I've got one from Wayne saying, thank you. With a smiley face. I love having the response already in place. My question, though, is what if I disagree with the feedback or plan not to do anything with it? How do I manage that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the great... Marshall actually shared this insight with us, and it's such an important insight. A big part of receiving feedback is staying, like we said, open to feedback. You want to make sure that you're always encouraging people. It's why the response is always thank you, not thank you very much or thank you, I disagree. Because anytime you start engaging in a judgment of the feedback or even a response to it, you diminish it in a certain fashion. So in the case of feedback that you get, that you feel it's important to respond to, I think our recommendation would be say thank you. Spend a considered time, and I'm not the time doing, but the time space time, like a day before you respond, so that the response doesn't sound reactive, but intentional.
Right. Thank you. You've given me some good things to think about, right? That's, you're not promising to do anything with it. And you can even, if you're soliciting feedback from multiple people that work with you, you can say, I'm collecting feedback from a number of different people. I really wanted to hear your input. And then you say, thank you. I really appreciate it. And that's it. And then you can come back maybe after you've talked with several of other people around the feedback that they've received. And you say, you know, I collected a lot of feedback from 10 different people. And there was one theme in particular that stands out to me. And that's going to be my number one priority to address. Mm-hmm. And it is this. And that may or may not, by the way, be the same thing that other person told you. But I think they'll respect the process and the thoughtfulness with which you're approaching it. Because I think most of us know we can't change everything all at once. As Marshall says, just pick one thing. Changing even just one thing is hard. So one thing at a time.
I think the other thing to consider is, even if you disagree with the feedback, there's information in what someone is telling you that is worth paying attention to, right? So if somebody says to you, you know, your feedback is you're showing up angry, and you disagree with that feedback, and in fact, even if the rest of the people would agree that you're not showing up angry, if this person thinks that you're showing up that way, they didn't say it for no reason. So it's worth considering why that feedback was given, and in there lies the value.
Well, and such great insights. I really appreciate that. And again, so many comments from attendees on this. And I love your points around, as soon as we move into judgment mode, then we're really diminishing it and diminishing our opportunity to learn from it. And I love how this is a common thread throughout the book, where it's really stay curious as long as you can, and then stay curious like 20 or 30% longer. Like, just keep there, because the better questions we ask to others and appreciation we show, and then vice versa, the better questions we ask to ourselves, that's going to optimize growth. That's going to optimize insight. This discussion of feedback has really prompted some great comments and questions. Lauren was wondering, so how do I set the stage so I can receive the best quality feedback from people around me?
Well, I mean, in the context of coaching, most coaches are going to want to start with a 360 feedback, where the coach will go out and ask the people, you know, the people who are, depending on where you are in leadership, people who report to you, your peers, and people you report to, for feedback on you. And the coach will assimilate that feedback, you know, in all likelihood, present it back in a fairly stark fashion. That is the best start for feedback. And then when you demonstrate that you're welcoming that feedback, you can open up the dialogue with people to give you feedback directly. But that 360 is probably the best way into creating the opportunity for feedback.
Because the 360 assessment is anonymized, people feel very safe in providing that feedback. One question we sometimes get asked is, will people really be honest with my coach and tell me the feedback that I need to hear? And the answer is, we have seen absolutely yes. People love being asked. In fact, it seems like some people are just like bubbling over. Yeah. I can't wait to tell you some of the things that they're seeing.
No, and I love that. And I think it's so critical, as you said, when you ask people for their perspective, they are happy to provide it. And I love that, the observation as well, in terms of, well, when you set the stage, and I love how both of you have commented on the importance of that 360 feedback, that continuous kind of feedback loop. Well, this isn't a one-stop shop, if you will. It's keep coming back and keep coming back. Can you talk about that idea a little more? Because I just love that. It reinforces, well, this isn't just a one-stop journey. This is continuous.
Well, I think that's exactly our openness framework is, it looks like a linear process, but it's actually a cycle. You meant to start with being open to change, which it helps you become open to feedback. You become open to taking action on that feedback, hold it, being held accountable for those things. And then it brings you back to the next thing. Are you open to changing something else or growing in a new way? And I think that's a large part of why we chose the word becoming in the title of our book, because we are always in this process of ongoing growth and becoming the very best versions of ourselves.
No, and I think it's such an important point. And I love that active side of it in terms of becoming, because it's, once again, it's not a end journey. This is a continuous one. And one of the other points that you make in the book as well, and you talk about not all change is good. You also talk about not all coaches are good. I love that, where you say, hey, we're going to provide this balanced perspective, if you will. So when you're talking, I love that you dedicated some space there around not all change is good. Can you walk us through that so that we understand, we can make more informed choices? Because I think it's a brilliant insight.
I think that some level of discernment or judgment is always a good idea. No process that I'm aware of is totally foolproof. And that's part of why we leave that space to say it's not always good. Now, is it more good than bad? Probably. But nonetheless, it's good to have some measured ideas and measured response. Because, for example, if someone wants you to make a change about your leadership or life, and it's genuinely not true to you, not true to your values or who you want to be, then making that change may not actually be in your best interest. And some level of introspection is important to understand the difference.
No, I love that. Also, just got a comment there. Love the point around values in terms of ensuring, as you just said, Jacqueline, you know, is this the type of person I want to be? And I love both of your observations about, well, this is an intentional choice, right? Like, so rather than just reacting to everything, we can't do everything, being a little more intentional, being very intentional about the choices we're making. And hey, as you also powerfully pointed out, change in one area, it's the sustainability. That's a fabulous accomplishment. I love that you talk so much around the accountability side. And I guess considering it's early in New Year and resolutions and how quickly they can dissipate, can you talk about that idea of accountability? I love how you talk about your coach being an accountability partner. What are some tips, tricks, techniques that we can use to be more accountable to the things we set ourselves out to do?
Yeah. Well, Marshall wrote an amazing book called Triggers, which is really the book about accountability. And in Triggers, he talks about a daily question process where you find someone who's willing to, well, I'll say hold you accountable, but really it's a, you're holding yourself accountable. Your daily question partner asks you questions that you write and you grade, but they listen to your answers. And so just remembering, because you do, you have to remember every day the things that you want to be held accountable for so that you can try to do better. Pet peeve of mine, you know, this time of year is the time of year, it's about this time of month that you start hearing all these stories about how everybody's broken their New Year's resolution already. What I discovered in the daily question process is you actually have a whole year to work on your New Year's resolutions. So for example, 1 year, my New Year's resolution was I had a sweet tooth. So I used to have dessert after dinner without fail. And my New Year's resolution was to not have processed desserts. I still have, you know, oranges and things like that, but not have processed dessert after dinner. And, you know, after a couple of weeks, naturally, I broke the resolution. But over the course of the year, I held it over 300 times. So you could say I broke it over 60 times, or you could say I held it over 300 times. And I consider that to be a real success. And I apply that to everything. I think we all can, is holding ourselves accountable for things on a daily basis rather than a long-term basis. If we do the work on a daily basis, the long-term basis is going to take care of itself.
And change is hard. Failure is natural, but not seeing failure as final. Every day is a new start and we can try again. I find that for me, having an actual person who helps hold me accountable is important. It's, for some people, there are great things like apps and other tools that they can use that help hold them accountable. For me, I'll just use an example. You know, one New Year, I decided I wanted to get more in shape. I wanted to go to the gym more. But after a few years of failing to do that, 1 year, I just said, you know what? I have to get a personal trainer. And so I hired a personal trainer, and when I had money on the line and I knew I was paying for my trainer, whether I showed up to the gym or not, it was the thing that got me moving and got me to the gym. But after a while of working with a trainer, I decided, I think I've learned what I needed to learn for now. And so I stopped working with a trainer, and lo and behold, I stopped going to the gym quite as much. Mm-hmm. But I realized, for me, with my husband, who is really great about going to the gym, as long as I timed my gym sessions to be at the same time as him, and he was going to drive to the gym anyway, so I might as well be in the car with him, that was the accountability push I needed. And now, for several years, I've been making it to the gym pretty consistently, 2 to 3 times a week, because my husband is, turns out, a great accountability partner.
Well, and again, so many great comments in the chat box. And in particular, I really appreciate the systems approach, right? Okay, so and love that you referenced Marshall's fantastic bestseller, Triggers, and around, okay, what systems do we have in place to support the changes that we're looking to make? And it's a great example, Jacqueline, around, hey, how can we capitalize on opportunities right in our environment? And Scott, I really want to also touch on the point that you made, so important. It's our mindset. How are we viewing things? And then what impact does that have on us as we look into the future? So rather than, oh, well, I had a processed dessert tonight, it's, well, hey, I didn't for 14 days previous. And maybe this sets up a beautiful segue. It was unintentional. You commented on backsliding. Someone had raised it earlier. Can you talk about that concept and how it fits into our development path in terms of being our best selves? Because I love that discussion you had in the book.
Backsliding is inevitable. There was a time, I think, we used to think that, you know, you have a coach, you spend a year, 2 years with the coach, and you're permanently fixed. That turns out just not to be the case. You know, we're human. We all revert to the mean, and habits that, you know, long-standing habits are very hard to break. With these accountability systems, we can move ourselves up. You know, we don't have to go from imperfect to perfect. I think if we can strive to go from imperfect to more, slightly more perfect, continue that growth path, then accepting that as the sort of a natural evolution for ourselves, we should get a lot of gratification from the progress that we make.
If I can use the example of, like, let's say the markets, you could look at price of housing or things, and you see it's a generally upward trajectory. But of course, there are points where it's still higher and lower along that upward trajectory. So we are still, like, if we look at the big picture, we're still getting better. We're still improving. We're still becoming better. But there are going to be days where we're down, and there are going to be days where we do really well. But I think sometimes taking a longer term perspective can be very helpful here.
Right. Having said that, I think it's also worth noting that there are times that we make quantum leaps. I think about the story of Hubert Joly that we talk about in the book, you know, smartest guy, McKinsey trained leader who felt that he had to give direction and he had all the answers. And he gets to Best Buy and with Marshall as his coach, realizes that is not going to win the day. And he has complete about face and recognizes that the employees are going to be the ones who have the answer. And he has the humility to reach out to the employees. And the experience of solving the issue and turning the company around in collaboration with the employees, I think permanently changed him. And I don't think he does go, today, certainly, but he doesn't go back and become that old time top-down leader. He goes on to like really lean into that and now wrote an amazing book called The Heart of Business, teaches at the Harvard Business School, and I think is a great example of how dramatic change really is possible.
And our friend, Dr. Gary Frotas, calls those unlock moments. This moment of awareness where things change and change permanently. You never quite see the world the same way. Of course, those flashes of insight are some of the most gratifying. And so certainly that is a very normal part of coaching, as is some of the smaller habits. Maybe it's, you know, again, listening better.
We can listen better most of the time. And then all of a sudden on an off day, we just shut it down. And it feels like a bit of a backslide, but pick it up the next day and, you know, keep moving forward.
No, and again, great examples that you're providing. It's the power of the and, you know, I'm going to make progress and I'm going to have some setbacks. And what do I learn from that? And I love your examples. You have so many. I mean, the examples you provide throughout the book of extraordinary CEOs and thought leaders who have made tremendous pivots in terms of their thinking and behavior as a result of that. And I love the frame quantum shift. It can happen and then, you know, and propel us forward. Another great section of the book, because I think this is vitally important. And when I reflect on my own coaching experience, you talk about the difference between progress versus perception, right? Like as I'm going through my coaching journey versus how people are perceiving that. I was thrilled when I was reading that. I was like, this is just so important. Can you unpack that idea for us? Because it's just, again, one of the many amazing insights in the book.
We talk a lot about how change is hard, right? Getting ourselves to change behavior that we've been doing for a long time, very difficult. Getting people to change their perception of you and recognize that you've changed your behavior, even harder. But that is a big part of the process of growing as a leader, is not just changing and hoping people will notice, but changing your behavior and changing people's perception of you. And stakeholder-centered coaching actually is an amazing process that a lot of our friends use, a lot of great coaches use. In stakeholder-centered coaching, a lot of the process, it's a monthly mini survey where you tell your stakeholders, I'm going to be working on, I use anger management again. It's not my problem. It just happens to be my go-to. But you say, I'm working on anger management and I'm going to check with you every month to hear how you think I'm doing. And in checking in with people every month, they are, number one, they're aware that you're aware that it's a problem and that you're working on it. Number two, they're asked to consider, are you making progress? And that repetition month after month is what starts to change the perception. We're just talking about backslides. Even if you backslide 6 months down the road, if you've been checking in with them every month, they're going to have that memory that you've been doing well every month. That month is the anomaly. If you don't check in, then 6 months down the road, they think, oh, I knew he wouldn't change. And so that check-in process and changing perceptions is so critical in really changing the perception as well as the behavior change.
And think about if you're checking in with people every month, how much more feedback you're going to be collecting. And that gets back to what we're saying about this. This is a cycle and a process. And that's not only going to just start really, again, giving you great feedback so you can make great change, but also changing perception at the same time. So, and improving those interpersonal relationships.
You know, as I think about it also, this idea of checking in with people leads into the idea of, you know, we talk in section 3 of the book, moving from a striving leader to a rising leader to a flourishing leader. The striving leader is in it for themselves. The rising leader is looking for their own benefit, even while they're creating benefit for others. And the flourishing leader is recognizing that by creating benefit for all, they also get benefit, but their intention is benefit for all. Demonstrating that you're in it for everybody else's benefit, not for your own, is, I think is a huge mark of the next generation of leadership. You know, the focus, the name of the podcast, Do Good to Lead Well. certainly anticipates this idea of the flourishing leader. And by the way, you know, the Gen Z generation is expecting this from leadership. They don't see it as often as they want to, but this is what they believe great leadership is about, is recognizing that a great leader has to care more about everybody else than they care about themselves.
And I love how in the book you talk about the virtuous cycle. I think, Jacqueline, you may have mentioned it earlier, how these things, when we are intentional, the stakeholder-centered coaching model, when we're following up with people, so powerful. And I love the observation as well, because you see it all the time, that observation, hey, change is hard. Changing others' perception of us is harder. And I find so often that people can be a bit discouraged around, well, look, I'm trying all these things. Mm-hmm. It's almost like your example, Scott, with the processed dessert. I haven't done it in four. And one time I'm a little short going with the angry side and can feel quite, you know, disheartened by it. Awesome that you both identified that and said, hey, that's part of the journey. And here's how you safeguard yourself. Absolutely love that. Time has flown by. I can't believe we're almost at the end. So I've had, so thank you. This is amazing. And again, as you can see, and I cannot recommend this book more highly. Please go out and grab a copy. And several people said that they will. I had multiple people ask this, and I'll try to paraphrase it here as we're nearing the end, around you've spoken and worked with so many amazing coaches and leaders and CEOs. If you can, what's your favorite or most surprising insights in the book?
You know, I think our favorite part of the book is the whole third section. That's what Scott was just talking about, where we talk about the different styles of leadership, and we put it on this 2x2 chart. And it talks again about that change for how we can identify ourselves. And are we in that position of being striving, people-pleasing, rising, or flourishing? And I think that really that piece about flourishing is what we're most excited about. And when we talk to people about that, and when we do speaking at conferences or other events, that's the part that I think people most resonate with towards the end. It's this really beautiful picture that we can paint around what great leaders look like and how leadership is really changing. And I think for some people, the response was, it feels like I have permission to believe that this is possible.
Yeah, the backstory on that is we had written the first 2/3 of the book and thought we were done. And we read it, you know, as one does. And we thought, you know, I know that there's a reason we're writing this book that's beyond just the technical aspects of, like, how does coaching work and how do you become coachable? And literally asked ourselves the question, to what end did we write this book? And in conversations with Marshall, a lot of walks and a lot of malls, and you'll see in that third section, it really is the conversation with Marshall that talks about the aspirations that we have for leadership. And it draws on a lot of historical examples, Frances Hesselbein, Ellen Mullally, Bear Jolie, who have demonstrated what's possible, and not to accept leadership as just growing, I mean, obviously not just growing shareholder value and not even just being good to your employees, but recognizing that flourishing is a holistic practice of leadership that cares about, number one, making sure that you as a leader are flourishing, meaning that you have a balanced life, not just you're giving everything to work. Because so many leaders have a phenomenal business career, and then at the end of their business career, they look back and they said, look, the sacrifices that they made personally, their family life and everything else weren't worth it. So understanding that early on so that you are part of flourishing. Secondly, that the employees and all the people that you're working with are part of flourishing. And you can't say that one aspect can be diminished dramatically for the benefit of the whole. That flourishing doesn't work that way. And then I think we would now not unfairly add, recognizing the planet itself is part of flourishing. That if we do things as leaders that diminish the planet, then we're not being the full flourishing leader we can be. For all of us involved in the project, that was the biggest inspiration that we took away from.
Awesome. I don't even know. This is like mic drop, almost like just cut to music. No, because, and again, so many comments, so inspirational. Thank you. Love the idea of flourishing. So important in today's world. Thank you for providing such valuable insights. And I would echo that. Like, this time has just flown by. What I love about the book and the final section, which I just dove into as well. And I love where you said, hey, you know, entertain us here. This is really important. And it is. It is just such a fantastic, the 2x2. And I've got comments saying,
I love this. I'm moving from rising to flourishing in the comments and how to do that. That's so important. So important in terms of our development to be our best selves. And what I love, which it just came out at me at every page, is that it really feels so strongly that both of you and your energy, I've had so many comments about your energy, you're so inspired to bring out the best in the reader so that they can bring out the best in the people around them. And it's so cool to have a book that accomplishes that in such a profound way. So thank you for writing it. Any final words before we sign off? This was just so awesome today.
Well, I think my final word would just be, if this resonates, take the first step. You might just surprise yourself.
To that early question about, can anybody become coachable? I think fundamentally, we believe anybody can become coachable. That all of the tools of becoming coachable are inside you. It's a choice that you make. And if you make that choice, really the flourishing that can come from becoming coachable and enacting some of the ideas that we put in the book are going to not just make your life a better life, and this is really our aspiration, but that for all the people that you love and lead, their lives will be better also. Mm-hmm. It's not a zero sum. It's not a 1+1=2. This is the potential for real exponential growth for you and those around you. And that's why really fundamentally why we wrote the book and do the work that we did.
It comes through in the pages of the book and then in conversation, you can just tell the energy is exceptional. So thank you for everything that you do. What an amazing conversation. And until next time, take care. Bye for now.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.